EMSradio.com.
EMS information for the next generation.
The EMS Garage is a production of EMSradio.com. You can find us on Facebook, just search EMS Garage. You can find us on Twitter at EMS Garage. Email us, emsgarage@gmail.com, or call us, 303-720-6001.
The EMS Garage.
Okay, I got the DC on the phone. They want to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Yeah, I'm going to 22 is on scene.
This episode of the EMS Garage is brought to you by Children's Hospital Colorado. To learn more information about Children's Hospital and their EMS programs, go to www.childrenscolorado.org.
Thank you. Can y'all hear me okay? Love the DJ. How cool is that? Shout out to the DJ. I have a terrible cold, so bear with me if I get a little bit hoarse or have to stop for a second for some water. We're going to talk today mostly about common patterns that you'll see, things that we don't want you to miss when you're out in the field. Talk about some things that maybe present a little bit more unusually. We're going to talk about how to document those things, and then the importance of the history when it comes to child abuse. And then we're going to talk about how important it is to know your mandated reporting requirements. Okay. There are some challenges in child abuse. Sometimes patterns are not present that aren't real obvious as to what happened to the child. Sometimes the history is misleading. In fact, most of the time, the history is going to be misleading. But if you stick to the general approach, the cornerstone of our diagnosis, which is, does the history fit the injury? That's how we're going to overcome these challenges. And I'm here to tell you that you might have maybe a second priority in your role as the pre-hospital provider. And as I was preparing for this talk, I was thinking, you know what? These people are so important when it comes to my job. Every case we get of a serious injury that comes in on the ambulance, I go straight for the trip sheet. I go hunt it down. Sometimes it's really hard to find. And then I make a copy and I put it in our permanent files. And it oftentimes comes up in court, or it comes up in my assessment and ultimate diagnosis. And that's because you can provide invaluable information about what the kid first looked like, how the initial history was presented. And you can do what no one in the hospital can do, and that's tell me what's going on at the scene. What did that house look like? What did that parent act like? What did that environment in which that child was living? How was it? Okay, so I know you like ABCs, so this is my little ABCD here. Not only do you want to assess the child, but assess the environment. Be observant. Look around you. Don't just look at the kid. Look at the entire environment. Consider, is this a safe place for a child? Is there something else going on here that I need to be aware of? What is my sixth sense telling me? And then don't just tell the nurse when you get to the hospital. Write it down. Okay? Write it down. And we're going to talk about how to write it down so that you don't come off being judgmental or ugly or accusatory. You're just objectively documenting what you see and what your concern is. So my job then, when I see a kid with a physical abuse injury, is to say, does this history fit the injury, as I've already mentioned? But not just that. Does it fit the severity of the injury? Does it fit the timing of the injury? So if it's a healed fracture, Does it make sense that the history has fell off the bed yesterday? Does it fit the location or the pattern or the developmental level of the child? So the massive head injury in the infant who's only 2 weeks old and the history is rolled off the couch, that's a problem because most two-week-olds don't roll. We have some top 10 red flags, and these are really important for me. Some of these may not fit your job, but think about the ones that do. All right, I've already impressed upon you the importance of history. Sometimes that history is absent. Sometimes it changes. So they may tell you on scene, rolled off couch. By the time they get to the ER, they may say, oh, actually rolled down the stairs. So if you don't document rolled down couch, and I get rolled downstairs, how is that going to help the authorities who have to investigate this and establish a pattern of untruths? Okay? A delay in seeking medical care is frequent because people hurt kids, hope they get better, then they don't, then they finally seek medical care, all right? The inappropriate affect of a caregiver, not a hard and fast rule. Most abusive parents love their kids and feel bad about their injuries, but you can document inappropriate affect on scene. So I'm reviewing a child fatality right now. EMS was called. Dad sounded really, really flat on the phone. My child's not breathing. Something's wrong. The kid came in with a very, very low core temperature, very, very low hematocrit. I think he had been down for a long, long time. And Dad either didn't want to admit it or just didn't know how bad the kid was hurt. But if you got on scene and saw this dad who was just kind of standing there, not panicked, probably because it had set in what had happened to him, that kind of affect is very, very important for us to note. Triggering events are things like crying, potty changing or diaper changing or potty accidents. Those are triggering events that frustrate parents, that can cause them to lose control and hurt kids. So again, if you go on scene and there's a poopy diaper on the floor in the bathroom where a kid has just been burned in the bathtub, that could be hugely important. All right, if they just say, oh, was in the bathtub, turn the water on themselves, but you see a big potty accident on the floor, that is very, very important because that could be the triggering event that caused that parent to lose control and get upset. Unrealistic expectations for a child, these are the kind of things that I'm gonna sort out. It's probably not your domain, but what we mean by that are, you know, I expect my two-year-old to sit at the table and eat dinner for 30 minutes and act like an adult. Right? That's an unrealistic expectation for that age kid. And that, again, could predispose you to getting frustrated and losing control. Crisis or stress in an environment. We're going to talk about this in a little bit more detail. You may not think that this is your domain, but it may be. Okay? So things like homelessness, poverty, domestic violence, substance abusing parents. These are more long-term crises or stressors in families that can predispose to poor parenting. And that goes along also with social or physical isolation of families. So parents who don't have support to give them help when they need it. A pattern of increasing severity or escalation of injuries over time isn't something, unfortunately, that we see quite a bit. So it's not uncommon for a kid to come in with a massive head injury, and a month prior, they were seen in their primary care office for a tiny little bruise in a one-week-old or something like that. Okay, so if you don't pick up on those little things, unfortunately, they can lead to bigger things. And again, prior history of abuse as a caregiver, it's not a hard and fast rule. Just because you're abused doesn't mean you're going to abuse or vice versa. But it certainly plays a role in your parenting eventually if you don't get treatment. So on scene. Okay, I just want to spend some time with you talking about these issues because this is really, I think, goes to the core of how you can be helpful in these cases. And I'm preaching to the choir. I think you could probably teach me a lot about what the acutely or critically ill child or patient looks like. But I just want to remind you, kids can be a little bit harder, babies especially, right? So they don't say, I've got a headache, I've got chest pain, my tummy hurts, my mom just punched me in the stomach, right? And the symptoms that they do present with can be nonspecific. Irritability, vomiting, that could be reflux. That could be a massive head injury. So it's really, really hard. If you're not thinking about at least keeping weird things in your differential, things like occult trauma, you're going to miss it. And remember, the history is always misleading. No one ever gets called to the house and gives the history, I just punched my kid in the stomach, I think they have a massive belly injury. All right? So pay attention. We've unfortunately had cases of kids with head injuries where someone's come to the scene, the kid looks pretty good, just a little bit fussy, and EMS has left the house because the kid looks okay, and then they go on to seize. Now, obviously, you're going to miss some, okay? We all miss some. But if you don't at least have it on your differential and pay careful attention to these subtle things, take all the clothes off. Because if you get called to the scene because the baby turned blue and stopped breathing, if you don't examine the whole body and you miss that one tiny little bruise on that two-week-old, that tiny little bruise on that two-week-old could change your entire assessment. Okay? So, obviously, if the kid is critically ill, you're not going to spend time. You're going to focus on your ABCs and your important triage issues. But when you're still trying to consider in your assessment of that sort of middle-of-the-road kid or kid that looks pretty good, but the history feels weird, think about these pearls. Take all the clothes off. Look behind the ears. Why? Kids get pinched back there. Look in the mouth. Kids get oral injuries that frequently go undiagnosed. Frenulum tears, tears of the frenulum underneath the tongue, or under the lip are very, very common. Palpate the rib. Maybe you'll feel a healing rib fracture. Okay? Look for unusual distribution of injuries. Look for the patterns that we're going to talk about. Think about where those injuries are. We're going to talk about which locations of the bodies are of more of a concern. And think about the age and developmental level of the kid. All right? So yeah, maybe it is just a fingertip bruise on that infant, okay? How many times have I said bruise on an infant so far? So kind of important, right? Think about developmentally why that kid would have that bruise and what's the history for it. These are all the social history questions I do with a social worker in the hospital in a consult that takes a couple hours. I'm not asking you to do this social history. I'm asking you to do this. These three pictures represent more in a social history than I could probably ever get in the hospital in an hour, right? Can I see this? No. Can you? Absolutely. What kind of drug abuser has that refrigerator? Right. That's taken from a home of someone who was making and dealing methamphetamine. Kids living in that home, okay? Kids under three with an empty refrigerator. Why? It's a massive appetite suppressant, okay? They can go days without eating. Okay, look at the arsenal on the wall here. That was also taken from a home where a picture was found on the refrigerator of a toddler holding a gun, okay? You could miss a picture on the refrigerator, right? Pay attention. Open your eyes. Look. You can really be helpful. Any questions about that? Okay, we're going to talk now more specifically about actual physical exam findings, and we're going to kind of start with the basics, so skin, and go from outside in to more serious injuries. A lot of times, the patterns are really straightforward, and we're going to see some of those today. Sometimes they're not super straightforward and they're just an indication that there's something else going on internally. They can mimic other conditions. All right, kids can have bleeding disorders and get weird bruises. All right, sometimes rashes can present as bruises. That's kind of more for us to sort out, but it's important for you to recognize and document. So you can see here, again, these are not hard and fast rules per se. It all goes back to the history and the developmental age of the child. So in general, where do kids who are toddling and walking around bruise? bony surfaces, forehead, shins, elbows. Why? Because that's where they fall and that's where they get contact bruises. Bruises on soft tissue surfaces are much more unusual. Bruising of the genitalia, unusual. Bruising of the ear is a little bit unusual because there's a triangle between the head and the shoulder and kind of the back of the head that kind of protects that area generally. So bruises are unusual in the ear. Bruises on the bottom, unusual. That being said, it goes back to the history, okay? So my 20-month-old was spinning in our living room and fell and hit his head on the corner of our armoire. Okay, got a big bruise across his ear. Very clear history. Kind of linear mark, so not diagnostic of abuse, goes back to the history and your concern. We see lots of injuries caused from things like grabs, slaps. Okay, so handprints are going to be common. Sometimes they present like the outline of the finger. Sometimes they present more like the imprint of the hand. Classic examples here. The larger, more vertically oriented photograph is a slap mark. The chin is a grab mark. Okay, underneath the jaw. This is a case of a child who came into the hospital. And our initial concern was that he had a slap mark on his face. Okay, so that raised our suspicion in the first place. The history was that he was in the care of mom's boyfriend, the unrelated male caregiver, all right? And there was no history of trauma. Had we not taken his clothes off, we would have missed the pinch mark on his penis and his spank bottom, okay? So he looked pretty good initially. But we were worried because we saw the slap mark, and then we took his clothes off and found these bruises. And then ultimately, he got a head CT, and a head injury was diagnosed. It was subtle. You can see he's not intubated. He's a little bit fussy, but he was in the hospital getting examined. He had a head injury, okay? And so this is how we documented our assessment. 2-year-old male with multiple body bruises, several pattern bruises, skin and soft tissue injuries, penis trauma, small left subdural hemorrhage. This constellation of findings is not explained by the reported history of a minor fall and is consistent with non-accidental trauma or child abuse. I personally don't like the term non-accidental trauma. I use the term child abuse because I think it makes sense and people kind of understand that. You don't have to make that assessment. That's my job. But you could document, this is unusual, this child has pattern bruises, bruises in soft tissue areas, and there's no history given to me by the parent. Is that ugly? Is that wrong? Are you putting your neck on the line saying it's child abuse? No, but you can borrow from our style of documentation to help support yours. Okay, I think my 2-year-old could recognize that this was abnormal bruising, right? Multiple bruises, another child with a subdural hemorrhage, lots and lots of bruises all over her body, lots of soft tissue injury. Injuries in all those places that we mentioned in our chart. So this is how it was documented. Multiple bruises over head, face, ears, chest, abdomen, arms, back, legs. Not consistent with one linear fall. Okay, that was the history given. The kid just fell and had multiplanar bruises all over, okay? The soft tissue distribution and nature of these injuries is diagnostic for child abuse. Again, you don't have to say that, but you can describe the different locations, what the bruises look like, etc. One caveat about bruises, we used to think that we were pretty good about dating them. We're not. How a bruise evolves and heals depends on the location of the injury, how the child was hurt. So avoid dating bruises. Don't let the cop on scene say, when did that occur? And let him push you into a corner about that. Okay, we're not really good at it. Other patterned injuries, besides hands, we see things like belt marks, looped cords, hair brushes, bite marks. Okay, these are more more easily diagnosed because they're really straightforward. This is an interesting case that raises the issue of the scene investigation. Brought in by actually mother and boyfriend. They were coming in because of some concern about him not moving his arms, but he had lots of bruises on exam. And he had some really weird pattern bruises. The looped cord, we were like, okay, that's a looped cord. But this other stuff on the leg, you can see these, does everyone see those little circles? Can you see those? We're like, that's weird. What is that? Scene revealed some Legos, some Duplo blocks. They were like, okay, this is definitely Duplo. Well, our PA, who's been on our team for 20 years, looked at that picture, looked at that Duplo, and she said, you know what? That does not fit. Go back to the scene. Go back to the scene and look again. And tucked in a closet, we found this belt that actually did fit in terms of the dimensions and length, all right? So this wasn't an EMS person who was looking in the closet, but I'm just raising the point to you how important that scene investigation is, how important it is that someone outside of the hospital like yourself give us as much information as we can get from the scene sometimes, all right? Okay, so this is, let's say this is a 9-year-old, and you're actually called because he's having an asthma attack, and you see this weird mark on his wrist. So you think, oh, well, I'll do a full, you know, survey, and I'll look him over. I've got time for that. And you see this stuff on his butt, and you're like, oh, gosh, I just went to that lecture. That doctor said I better look everywhere and then think about pattern bruises. This must be abuse, right? So what's helpful about a 9-year-old? Exactly. So this got referred to us. This is abuse. Oh, my gosh. We asked him, what happened? This was the summertime. Typical 9-year-old. He was in the pool. There was some suction in the drain. He thought it was hilarious to have his butt and wrist sucked up by the drain, and he got some bruises. We thought that fit perfectly. Okay? So, again, use all of your information. Use all of your skills and tricks. Ask that 9-year-old. You don't have to interview them. You can just say what happened. And sometimes they'll tell you, okay? All right, we're going to move away from external injuries now and talk about internal, more serious injuries, things that the law enforcement officers know. Serious bodily injury. Yes, sir.
Just a quick question about bruises before we move on. If we can't necessarily time them, are we still worried about variable stages of healing?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. So yellow pigment is the best you can do. Yellow usually occurs within about 18 hours, or after about 18 hours. So if you see a lot of red, purpley bruises and also some yellow ones, you can say, yeah, that this is serious concern for kind of varying stages of healing. So, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I just think it, I mean, you're a medical person. Is it ever inappropriate to examine any age kid with, or any age person? I think it's fine. If you're worried, you examine the patient. I mean, you know, you've got someone else there with you. It's not like you're going to be unchaperoned, or I think if you're worried, you look. No? Am I totally off the mark there?
Follow your gut.
What's that?
Follow your gut.
Yeah. I think it's okay, you know. Hey, y'all are going to be doing C-sections in the ambulance, so you can look at a butt. That talk made me very nervous. Okay, so serious bodily injury usually refers, it's actually a legal term. That means you've got an injury like a burn, a greater than second degree burn, a fracture, or injury to an organ that's going to threaten your life or the organ itself. Okay, and so these are more serious injuries. They usually indicate that the crime is a felony as opposed to a misdemeanor. This actually, yeah, this would be serious bodily injury because it's a second degree burn. So this is a kid who got dropped off at school, and mom said, oh, she's got this funny rash. And thank goodness there was an astute school nurse who's like, wow, that's an unusual distribution, very discreet for a rash, you know, something weird here. Again, the importance of going to the scene and figuring out what fits. School nurse couldn't do that. I can't do that. Someone's got to go look. Usually it's law enforcement. But, you know, you could be potentially finding stuff like this. So burn patterns are common. A lot of times we see cigarette burns. Iron burns, not uncommonly accidental. Okay, again, it goes back to the history that's provided for that burn. And then we're going to look at the immersion burns, some pictures. Those are more classic child abuse injuries. So an immersion burn means that it's in the distribution of what would be in a glove or a sock, okay? And that's an indication that the child's hand was forcibly held underwater, because a kid is just like you or me. If they put their hand in water, they're going to reflexively draw back. They're not going to submerge their hand even deeper into the water. All right, so this means they were held down. There's usually not splash marks. There's that really well-delineated water line. This is a classic skull burn. A lot of times the bottom of the foot is spared because it's thicker skin, so it doesn't burn as easily, and also because the bathtub is a little bit colder compared to the surrounding water, so it's not unusual to have some sparing at the bottom of the feet. Or sometimes the bottom of the butt is spared if a kid is emerged in a seated position and their butt cheeks touch the tub. This is, again, look how tiny that hand is. That's a little tiny baby. Babies who can't even, intentionally reach for stuff. So this is a problem here. That's that child who was submerged in a seated position. One little caveat, and I don't know if y'all have kind of formal protocols for this, but we're seeing a lot of people, not necessarily EMS providers, but people outside of the hospital, taking pictures on their cell phone. I would avoid it. Let the cops know that you see something weird and that they should get a picture of it. I think that's just really, really good practice. Or let the ER know, and if they have a camera, they can take a picture. You'll hear me use the term abusive head trauma instead of shaken baby syndrome. We use shaken baby syndrome in the lay media. A lot of our prevention campaign stuff, we still use that term. But really the preferred term is abusive head injury, because we recognize that there are a lot of different ways that you can hurt a baby's head and brain besides just shaking them. So there's probably something unique about the acceleration and deceleration trauma that comes with shaking, but you can mimic that force with blunt force impact with like a slam, and sometimes kids are shaken and then slammed, or sometimes they're just simply slammed. All right, so we don't use the term shaking. We occasionally see smothering, but those are really diagnoses of exclusion. It's very difficult to differentiate between smothering and a SIDS-like death on autopsy, unless you get a history from somebody that's worrisome, or you've got like bruises over the mouth or something like that. So when I talk about abusive head injury, what I'm usually referring to is subdural hemorrhage, plus minus hypoxic injury to the brain tissue itself, and then retinal hemorrhages. Occasionally we'll see other occult injuries, especially rib fractures or other types of fractures. Very important for you to note, oftentimes there is no external sign of injury. So if you're shaken alone or slammed to a soft surface, you may not have fracture or bruising to the outside of the head. All right? So this is where kids get missed. If there's no sign of trauma, there's no history from the family that the kid was hurt, and they just present with irritability and a little vomiting, they might get labeled as meningitis or reflux. So you've got to have it on your differential. Think about the other things. Is it vomiting alone without diarrhea and fever? Then it's probably not a gastro. If it's new onset vomiting and it's not associated with fever, feeding, it's probably not reflux. Okay, so use all your clues. This is a child where EMS was called. This was an outside city or smaller location. Presented with apnea, seizures, and I think the outside facility actually thought that this child had meningitis. And we got the call that they were transferring this kid for meningitis and PICU admission. And there was, again, no history of trauma provided by anybody. But you can see, actually, so massive cerebral edema. The normal gray-white architecture of the brain is obliterated. There's bright white interhemispheric subdural, although quite thin. That's very common in our cases. You can see there's so much swelling that the ventricles are smushed over and small. This portends a very, very bad prognosis, and sure enough, this child actually survived, but this CT was taken months later, and you can see that most of his brain just sort of necrosed away. Severe, severe sequelae. Okay? There's a lot of stuff in the lay media right now that shaken baby doesn't exist. All right? Most of that is medical, legal. It's a controversy being created by a handful of people who spend most of their time doing defense work. I'm here to tell you, this is real. Okay? This is real. All right, fractures. This is a 7-day-old with leg, arm, and swelling. Had been sitting in a hospital for about 4 days, getting worked up for angioedema, I think. Okay. Bruises on the arm, swollen arm. I was worried about compartment syndrome. 3 days in another hospital with multiple broken bones. Okay. Do y'all see all those fractures? Do I need to point them out? Okay. So I documented leading diagnosis for the bruises, the fractures, the swelling, blah, blah, blah. 2 weeks later, we took another skeletal survey. Sometimes we'll pick fractures up that aren't apparent with the first injury because they're subtle and we don't see them until they're healing. This is a classic child abuse fracture. It's a metaphyseal fracture. Remember, the metaphysis is that very vulnerable end of the bone in a young child where the bone is changing from cartilage to hard bone. And oftentimes they're described as bucket handle because you see they look like they're the handle of a bucket. And so that vulnerable cartilaginous area is sheared or pulled away from the long bone. So you probably know, spiral fracture, twist. Transverse fracture, blunt force impact, that kind of thing. Metaphyseal fractures, we just talked about the mechanism there. Most of the time, there's a combination of forces at play, so try not to get too forensic in your assessment. I mean, certainly they can be helpful, but it all goes, again, back to the history. It's more than just the specificity of the fracture. A lot of times we'll hear spiral equals abuse. Not necessarily. Again, it depends on the history. So if a kid is falling and caught by the leg and they twist, that could be an accidental mechanism, or you'd get a spiral fracture. So oftentimes it just goes back to those histories, and very commonly we pick up occult fractures that are not clinically suspected. So if we see a kid who has a bruise or has some other weird injury, we often get a skeletal survey in kids 2 and under, roughly, and see if there's other stuff that we're missing. Fractures that are more specific are things like rib fractures, because they're pretty hard to get unless you've got high impact trauma. In an infant, they're usually from squeezing of the chest. Scapular and spinous process fractures are really just uncommon and kind of typical household accidents, so they usually come from higher impact. Just to point out, the rib fractures is really the main purpose for this slide here. They look like these kind of white thumbprints. These are healing rib fractures, so oftentimes we don't see fractures until callus forms around the fracture site and the rib fracture is healing. This is unusual. This is a child, multiple bruises, as you can see, and we can actually feel the callus on the outside of the body, or see it as well. This is just the mechanism with that anterior posterior compression of the chest. Questions about injuries before we move on? I'm sure you all know, but it's worth highlighting, you're a mandated reporter, okay? That means if you have suspicion of abuse of a child, you have to report it. Do you have to have proof? No. And there are good faith clauses that protect you. So if you report an error and you're wrong, you're protected. Also, information sharing among police, social services, other providers is also a priority, so you're protected. You don't need to have releases signed. You're protected from HIPAA, okay? So very important to know. So I just kind of want to leave you with this, because this is so important. You could be the first person to get a history. And I hope today I've impressed upon you the importance of a history in my job and my diagnosis. Okay? Be objective in your assessment. You don't need to say, Dad looked like a jerk, Mom was a loser. But you can tell me why you think Dad was a jerk in an objective manner. So Dad was asleep on the couch. He slurred his words. He smelled of alcohol. Okay, that tells me a lot. It's very objective. It can be very important. Things like inappropriate and appropriate sound kind of nice, sound kind of at arm's length here, but they don't really tell me that much, so avoid those terms. Avoid the term shaken baby syndrome. It just can get messy. You know, just say, I'm worried this is head trauma or something like that. Avoid interviewing parents. Avoid asking parents if they shook their child, because sometimes they can get bad, bad head injuries that aren't from shaking. Okay, and then parents can start thinking up histories and excuses. And a few other caveats. Obviously, whatever you can do can help, but it should never be at your own expense. So know your system protocols, and if you're on scene and it feels unsafe, that's the priority, not looking at the kid's butt or whatever. And know your limits, okay? So I often feel so bad for the EMS providers who come in on a kid with a child fatality, because they're sort of like bystanders. They bring the kid here, they know it's bad, and then they leave. And they don't get that follow-up. They don't get that closure. So by all means, if you ever want to know what happened with a case, give us a call. We're happy to talk to you about it. And take care of yourself, because it can be really hard just to be sort of that bystander. All right? You're going to see victims of child maltreatment, okay? They're challenging cases emotionally and sometimes medically, but you can play a huge role. You've got to have an index of suspicion, and when you have that suspicion, document it in an appropriate manner, okay? And consider trauma in these patients. In that weird history where your gut just feels funny, think of trauma, and if so, activate your trauma protocols as necessary. And thank you for your time.